We'll call the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. Clerk will note the roll. Do note that a quorum is present. Members, according to your agenda, we'll proceed to item number 3, and that is the approval of minutes. We do have 3 sets of minutes to approve. We'll take them in chronological order. That means that the minutes from May 4th, 2005 are the first to be considered. Are there any additions, deletions, or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, Representative Nelson moves the May 4th minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, the next set of minutes are dated January 11th, 2006. Are there any additions, deletions, corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, Representative Hilty moves the January 11th minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Those minutes are adopted. Finally, members, minutes dated February 22nd, 2006. Any additions, deletions, or corrections to those minutes? Okay, seeing none, Representative Ellison moves the February 22nd minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. Members, as you know, today we're assembled to consider House File 2846, Chairman Johnson's eminent domain bill. The way I plan to proceed regarding the bill today, members and those assembled, is that Representative Johnson has an author's amendment initially, which will put the bill into the form in which he would like to discuss it. Representative Johnson will then discuss his bill. I have approximately 20 people listed as witnesses. Some opposed, some in favor of the Johnson bill. So we're going to take an hour of testimony, and that means 3 minutes each for the assembled witnesses. I would note that in addition to that hour, we have had extensive testimony, I think, at the Blaine City Hall, town hall meetings. I'm sure all of us have, my experience is not unique in being besieged by lobbyists regarding this bill, so I would assume that most members of this committee are fairly informed and ready to vote today. So we're going to do an hour of that. Then Representative Ellison has an amendment. We will duly consider his amendment as part of our committee discussion and move to a final vote on the bill. And with that, Chairman Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will, I'll move my amendment first.
Yeah.
That's the H2846A9 amendment.
Chairman Johnson, I hate to correct the chairman. Let's move your bill first, and then we'll move your amendment.
Fine idea. I will move House File 2846 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. And then I will move the H2846A9 amendment. It puts it in. It simply changes slightly the definition of public service corporations to include airports, and we can discuss that at some point later in this meeting if necessary, but it simply puts the bill into the format that I would like.
Without objection, so moved. As said, members, we will discuss that change later, but now the bill is in the author form. The author would like to discuss it. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you all well know, we have been working on this particular bill for many months now, and in fact, there are some people who have been working on this particular issue for years, at least pieces of this bill. And I can tell you that since I first got involved 8 or 9 months ago, maybe even a little longer than that, the bill has changed very significantly. And it's changed on several different occasions, I think, to address some very valid, legitimate concerns that have been raised by different governmental entities as well as different individuals who had an interest. But while the bill has changed, there really have been two very basic fundamental principles in the bill that have stayed the same and that I am hopeful will stay the same throughout the next 5 or 6 committee stops that I have. And they are these. Number one, that when government uses the power of eminent domain to take someone's property for economic development purposes, in other words, to take from one private entity and transfer to another private entity, that ought to be very difficult. Not impossible, but it ought to be very difficult. And it should only be allowed when there is something wrong with the property that is being taken. That's principle number one. Principle number two is when government is using its power of eminent domain to take for a traditionally public use or public purpose, such as a road or a school or a park or a government building, we don't want to stand in the way of that. That's a very important tool for government. but we want to make sure that the property owner is getting paid a fair price, just compensation, as required by the Constitution. Those are two fundamental principles that are in this bill. They were there on day one, and they're still there, despite a lot of changes to the bill. With respect to the details of the bill, we have changed the bill again and again and again. A few weeks ago, this was, I believe, a 16-page bill. At one point, this was a one-sentence bill. That's the bill that I first introduced. And it's now, I think, a manageable 5.5 pages. And those changes have been made based upon input from people who thought that the bill went too far or restricted governmental entities too much. I'm willing to talk more. I'm very willing to talk more and make more changes to those details. But I believe we've gone an awful long way. In fact, I know we have. And I think we have a very reasonable bill that does not go off the deep end, as some people suggest it is. And I can tell you, I mentioned that I introduced the one-sentence bill at the end of the last special session. That's where I started. A pretty blanket statement that you essentially can't use eminent domain for economic development. That's a far cry from what we've got here. And when I go out to communities, I've been traveling a lot, talking to Rotary Clubs and Chambers of Commerce and having town meetings on eminent domain, I show this bill to people and I walk through it, and they understand it. People can read through this and understand what the bill says. It's almost universal. You've watered this down too far. In fact, I'm trying to think of the last time a citizen who wasn't a lobbyist told me that this goes too far. It's almost universal that this doesn't go far enough. So please keep that in mind as we talk about potential attempts to make the bill make it easier to use eminent domain than what the bill does. I can also tell you one more story, and then I'll walk through the bill. I was talking to the Fargo-Moorhead Chamber of Commerce a couple weeks ago via telephone, and it was mostly city and county folks that were there, and Heidi Heitkamp, who is the former Democrat Attorney General of North Dakota, is carrying the constitutional amendment proposal in North Dakota to restrict eminent domain, and then I talked about our efforts in the Minnesota legislature to do the same in Minnesota. She went first, they had a nice conversation, and then I presented my bill, and one of the Moorhead City Council members, who happens to be a Democrat, said to me, you know, I don't love your bill, Johnson, but thank you for being so thoughtful and so reasonable and trying to allow us to still use eminent domain when we need it. So I hope everyone keeps that in context. Much of the pressure is to move to a stricter or more restrictive version of this bill. This is all about balancing two important interests, and we do this all the time in the legislature. On the one hand, we have the interest of government to take people's property for what government believes is a public good or a common good. And on the other hand, we have the right of ordinary citizens to own their own little piece of land or their own home or their own business without worry that the government will come in and take it away from them because the government believes that somebody will put it to a different or better use. When we are talking about situations that aren't a traditional public use like a road, but rather economic development, I think the balance needs to tip very strongly in favor of that individual citizen who owns the property. And that's what this bill would do. Let me very briefly walk through the bill. If we get to a lot of technical questions, I'm probably going to need some help with that, but I'll do my best. The first provision there, Section 1, is simply a preemption provision, and it's language that it says that the language in this bill prevails with respect to eminent domain takings. And subdivision 2 there says there's no implied authority for eminent domain. If an entity isn't specifically given eminent domain power, it doesn't have eminent domain power. Section 2 is the definition section, and I'm not going to go through all of those definitions, but the very last one is really important, and it will refer back to a few others. So page 3, line 3.11, the last definition in the bill is the definition of public use or public purpose. And what both the state and federal constitution tell us is that government cannot take through eminent domain except for a public use. And some courts have expanded that to also say a public purpose. So we are specifically defining that. And we're saying that it means three different things. Public use or a public purpose means exclusively, number one, possession, occupation, ownership, and enjoyment of the land by the general public or by public agencies. That is our traditional definition of public use, a road or a government building or a school. Number two, the creation or functioning of a public service corporation. Broadly, that means utilities. And then number three, the big four economic development exceptions. Mitigation of a blighted area, remediation of an environmentally contaminated area, reduction of abandoned property, or removal of a public nuisance. And all four of those four exceptions are defined in the definition section. So taking the last one, public nuisance is line 3.3 above that. It simply says it's how it's defined in law, which kind of, in a nutshell, says that if this is a piece of property that is a danger to the community's health or safety, that's a public nuisance. A meth house would be a good example of that. Reduction of abandoned property, that is defined on page 2, line 2.11. Property that's not occupied and for which the condemning authority is unable to identify and contact the owner despite making reasonable efforts. That doesn't mean it's just property that's not being used. It's property that's truly been abandoned. Going backwards, one more definition on page 3, remediation of an environmentally contaminated area. That's defined on line 2.27 and below. And what we've said is that more than 50% of a surface area needs to be contaminated for it to be considered to fall under the statutory exception, and it has to be significantly contaminated. What this says is that the costs of investigation, monitoring, and remediation need to exceed 100% of the assessor's estimated market value for the contaminated area. So it has to be serious contamination. And then finally, mitigation of a blighted area, and this may be the most controversial piece. Our definition of blighted area is on line 2.14, and it says a blighted area means exclusively, at the time of condemnation, an area that's zoned for and used for urban use, so something in a city essentially, and where more than 50% of the buildings are dilapidated. And then dilapidated is defined below that, and you need to show three things. The building that's considered dilapidated must be cited for at least one building code in the previous year. The property owner must have chosen not to fix the violation of the building code. And then number three, and this is really important, it has to be a really serious problem. The building has to be unfit for human use. That is a high standard. I fully recognize that. But it's certainly a standard that can be met in very serious situations. So that's our definition section and definition of public use. Go to section 3, starting on line 3.21. This says that if you have a blighted area or environmentally contaminated area and you want to take part of that 49.99% that is not dilapidated or is not environmentally contaminated, you have to show that taking that is absolutely necessary to remove the dilapidated buildings or to remediate the environmental contamination. Again, a high standard, but certainly meetable. Subdivision 3 on line 3.31, if a developer contributes to environmental contamination or blight, you can't factor that into the determination as to whether eminent domain applies. If you move to page 4, there's an attorney's fee provision at the top there. This piece says that if government attempts to take someone's property through eminent domain and the property owner challenges in court and wins, the property owner gets their attorney's fees paid by the governmental entity. And a win means either under A, they get 20% more than the last written offer, the final written offer of the governmental entity, or the court finds that there can be no taking at all. Either of those is considered a win. Section 5 below that changes the evidentiary standard that we currently use in cases of those four exceptions for economic development that I mentioned before. This does not entail the whole bill. It only entails a taking for mitigation of a blighted area, environmentally contaminated area, abandoned property, or removing a public nuisance. And in those cases, it will now be the burden of the government to show by clear and convincing evidence that this is for a public use, that it's necessary and for a public use. That is a significant change and possibly the most important piece of this bill. Right now, the standard is essentially substantial deference is given to government when they take property through eminent domain, which means as long as you can make a straight-faced argument, that's pretty much good enough. This will create a very high standard for the government to meet before a government can take someone's property in order to transfer it to another private entity for economic development. It also includes a piece that says that if it is appealed to the Court of Appeals, the case will be heard de novo. Line 4.25 and below, it's compensation for loss of going concern. This simply says that if a business property is taken, and I think it only applies to a total taking, the going concern must be factored into the value, to the valuation, not necessarily just the value of the land or the building. The next page, line 5.16, section 7, it presents a requirement of minimum compensation, and it must be compensation sufficient for an owner to at least purchase a similar house or building of equivalent size in the community and not less than the condemning authority's payment or deposit under an earlier section. There's a limitation under that a government cannot require the owner to accept as part of compensation a substitute or replacement property. 5.25 just defines the public service corporation, as we've slightly changed with my author's amendment. Line 5.28 and really the rest of the bill requires a public hearing. If a city government is going to take through eminent domain, they have to hold a public hearing and they actually have to vote on the bill. That, Mr. Chairman, is the bill in a nutshell, and now I don't know if you want to move straight to testifiers or what you'd like to do.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. That's what I'd prefer to do. Let's move on to the witnesses, and then what we will do is move, I think, to consider Representative Ellison's amendment, because I think it's important enough and changes the face of the bill enough. If it's successful, we should probably consider it first before we move on to consider the bill in its entirety and pose questions to the author and to others. So with that on the list, I've got Ms. Schlander first, Mr. Berg on deck, and Mayor Skogquist in the hall. So, folks, we got people who have been here before. You all know Ms. Schlander. You're familiar. Just if you'd identify yourself for the tape, of course, for future reference, and then proceed with your testimony. And, again, we are limiting testimony to 3 minutes for each person. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. I think I will limit my testimony. Representative Johnson did a fabulous job explaining the bill and explaining how we all got here. So I know that committee time is valuable. I think I'll just hold my testimony and let others speak so then I could be available to answer questions after testimony is over, if that's okay with you.
That's great. Thank you, Ms. Schlander. Mr. Berg. Not here? Mitch Berg, right? Mayor of Afton. Not in the house. Mayor Skogquist. All right. Move on. Mr. Hall, Marcus Hall. Come on down. And then after that, I have Mayor Longry and Mr. Grotz. Good afternoon, Mr. Hall. Welcome to the committee. And please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Marcus Hall. I'm the Public Works Director and the County Engineer with St. Louis County. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota County Engineers Association Legislative Committee. And today I'm here to speak on behalf of the County Engineers and express our concerns over this bill and other eminent domain reform provisions that are presented. We are all well aware of the Kelo decision, and I'm sure that every one of us have heard a horror story about the improper use of eminent domain. However, I think that if you take a closer look at the number of parcels acquired each year in Minnesota, you will find that abuses are very rare. For example, in the last 4 years in St. Louis County, we have acquired over 500 parcels for highway projects, none for economic development or blight redevelopment, and of these 500 parcels, we have only resorted to eminent domain on 4 parcels, less than 1%. We use condemnation on one of these parcels because of title problems. On the other 3 parcels, it was not just the settlement that the landowner disagreed with, but also they disagreed with the project itself. We currently have a process in the state of Minnesota that we use to acquire properties, and we feel that it's adequate in protecting landowners' rights. In all 3 of these cases that I previously mentioned, we reached agreement with the landowners after the commissioner's ruling, and either side appealed the commissioner's decision to district court. The vast majority of the horror stories that I have heard about center around economic development projects and not transportation projects. We believe the county engineers are very sensitive to the use of eminent domain, and we use this power sparingly to transfer private lands to public use. It is a very important tool, but we do not feel that it is overused or abused at our level. When I say that abuses are very rare, I do not mean to downplay the importance of any abuse. Even if government uses its power one time to abuse in an abusive manner over its residents, it's too much. But I don't see how some of the provisions in this bill do anything to stop this injustice. One provision of the bill regarding attorney fees will preclude us from reaching settlement that is more than 20% greater than the last written offer without paying attorney fees. 20% is not a hard threshold to obtain in areas of rapidly rising land values or in strip takings for roads where damages are nominal because of the minimal amount of property affected. For example, a $500 offer for damages related to shoulder work would only have to increase to $600 to award mandatory attorney fees in the hundreds of dollars. Other provisions dealing with compensation for loss of going concern will only invite litigation. Traditionally, counties pay for the land, the building, relocation costs, and reestablishment costs of businesses that must be relocated. Establishing value for going concern is extremely subjective.
And we'll wrap up, please, Mr. Hall.
What's that?
You wrap up, please.
Okay. Thank you very much for listening to me today. I think it's important that we can come to some conclusion on this process that all parties can agree to. And by listening to and involving county engineers, AMC, and MICA, I think you can create a bill that will reduce or, if not, eliminate abuses in eminent domain. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Mayor Longry. Mr. Jim Groats. Frank Johnson. Oh, he's here. I'm sorry. And then after Mr. Groats, you'll have to tell me how to pronounce it. Thank you. Frank Johnson, Lori Lauder, and then Keith Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Groats, and I'm from Edina, Minnesota. I'm in favor of this bill. I wish to address one section with regard to attorney's fees. Having gone through a very problematic process recently with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, I feel the attorney's fees provision is fair, but also I feel that in many cases, citizens have a tendency to just get bowled over when this happens to them. And I found the highway department, there were some individuals willing to work with you, but in other cases, they were not. We don't have standards in this area. And I feel that perhaps this section could be enlarged to accommodate a broader set of standards in those cases involving the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the Highway Department. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Groats. Mr. Frank Johnson. Good afternoon, Mr. Johnson. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Frank Johnson. I'm a farmer living in Renville County, Minnesota, and I want to thank you for this privilege of addressing this group in regard to this proposed bill on eminent domain. Initially, I have to say that I'm very pleased with what has been initiated on this bill. I do have a copy of comments that I have made going through each section of the bill. And I think rather than address them all in the time that's got, I'd like to leave a copy with Representative Johnson, and you can look over what I've stated. There's some pieces that I would like to enlarge on, some change a little bit. I'll give you one example real quickly in the one section. I don't recall the exact section. I can tell you in a minute here. Section 18, where they want to change the name of the bill of eminent domain from the right of eminent domain to the power of eminent domain. And I rather object to that. If you look up the meaning of each of those words, it changes the thought of the whole bill a little bit. The one experience I've had with eminent domain indicates to me that the people that get the right of eminent domain have all kinds of power. And I don't think it's a proper connotation of that. I have marked a few other sections on mine that I would like to talk about. I'd like to comment and applaud Representative Johnson for initiating this. And one of the reasons I'm so interested in talking about it It's been 30 years since I was first exposed to an eminent domain project on my property. And that took about 2.5 years. Then exactly 20 years later, in 96, the second one happened. And in between there, there was a third one, in between there, in the early 80s. So when you've gone through that a few times, you begin to absorb some things that occurred. And one of the things is that if the arrangements have not been completed prior to construction of a project, it puts the landowners in a very difficult position. Their position normally is you wait, the commissioners will take care of it. If any of you have gone through a commissioner hearing, you'll find out they're not very much fun. And usually they don't always reach to the root of the whole problem. I would like to suggest that if the final arrangements are not completed between the person or entity that receives the power of eminent domain, if they're not completed before construction, that the landowners should have the right to have their attorney bills awarded to them if they have to fight to get their desires to where they would like to have them. My personal experience over these years, there's another one a little later on that, but there's three of them I was intimately involved with, and it was extremely difficult to arrive at a mutually acceptable amount of compensation for both the person that was building the project and the landlord that was affected. And the other thing that I've mentioned in your bill is that I would like some more comments placed on outstate issues of eminent domain. There's one you're pointing out is very good. In fact, the matter I read...
We could wrap up, please, Mr. Johnson.
19 states have already indicated bills on this, and now we have to have... I'm going to leave a few words for outstate Minnesota, as well as the metro. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. What we'll do is we'll have the clerk take your remarks, and we'd be happy to provide them to the whole committee. Thank you. Thanks for taking time to come down today from Hector. Lori Lauder. And then Keith Carlson, and after that, Miles Seppelt, and then Jeff Eaton. Feel free. You can grab a chair there from the end. You don't have to stand.
Mr. Chairman and Commission members, thank you. Committee members, thank you very much. We appreciate our being heard here today. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm the Director of Development for the St. Paul Port Authority. Our mission is to retain businesses and create jobs through brownfields redevelopment efforts. Since 1996, for example, we have created and retained nearly 21,000 good-paying jobs in St. Paul. Over the past 10 years, the Port Authority has carved 18 manufacturing business centers out of polluted and often abandoned land. The real estate investment in these business centers has totaled over $166 million. Our projects alone have resulted in the retention of more than 3,600 jobs and businesses paying real estate taxes totaling $4.6 million. I'm here to talk about two main reasons that the Port Authority opposes the Johnson Bill. It will make nearly impossible for an agency such as ours being involved in neighborhood and community revitalization to clean up industrial polluted sites. And it will make nearly impossible to obtain the last piece of property needed to redevelop and reinvest in these communities. Let me explain a few more details. First, this bill will severely limit our ability to redevelop land that is unsafe, structurally unsound, and/or polluted. Heavily polluted land is too expensive for private developers to redevelop, and therefore it lies dormant for years, infecting the surrounding homes and businesses. We are able to redevelop properties that the private sector cannot because it cannot pencil out an adequate return on investment. In order to redevelop brownfield sites, it's essential to acquire neighboring properties, to do land assembly. Under this bill, every property we would acquire would have to be polluted or contaminated. That is simply not a realistic view of neighborhood revitalization. Piecemeal won't get the job done. I specifically urge you to consider the environmental impact of the bill because the bill will actually limit us in cleaning up polluted sites. Let me go to a couple of examples, and please refer, if you would please, to some information in your packets here, the pictures here. First of all, to create the Westminster Junction Business Center on the east side of St. Paul, which was an award-winning project, the Port Authority needed to acquire 8 parcels of land to be able to locate the Twin Cities Federal Credit Union. Roughly half the block was contaminated and taken through eminent domain, and the homes of 6 residents were acquired through negotiation and purchase. One property owner was a holdout, and while this property was not contaminated, its location on the block would have prevented the development of this block. Therefore, it was necessary to use eminent domain for the credit union, and as a result, the Westminster Business Center has private investment totaling $68 million. In the second example, the Great Northern Business Center itself...
If you could wrap up, please, Ms. Louder.
Yes, thank you. We were able to condemn out an easement interest in order to make that project happen. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. I have 2 members here. I hope that you would be willing to listen to them from St. Paul as well. They'll keep their comments short.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Certainly, if you'd keep your comments brief, please, and, of course, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Kendall Crosby, and I'm the owner of Kendall's Ace Hardware on Dale and Como, which is 2 blocks away from the Maxim Steel site, which is now the Great Northern Business Center. In 1992, I purchased my store, and the junkyard that was down there was holding back our store from the sales that we could have reached in a better neighborhood that didn't have everyone driving past this bad site. In 1999, when the Port Authority was involved, we went and did a remodeling on the front of our store and had a 25% increase in business. My point is we tried to get our neighbors to also remodel the fronts of their businesses. They wouldn't do anything because of the eyesore that was down there. Once the new business center has taken over, we've put in $1.2 million worth of improvements on the front of the buildings that are all around our businesses on our corner. We've gone from $250,000 a year in 1992 to last year we did $780,000. It wouldn't have happened without that site being taken care of. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kristen Kidder, Executive Director with the District 7 Planning Council in the Frogtown area in St. Paul, and also I've lived in Frogtown for 15 years. About 10 years ago, the community came together and created a vision to redevelop railroad property sites that had been left blighted, contaminated, underutilized, and the community came together and said, we need this area in the center of our community to be redeveloped, brought back to life, bring good paying jobs to people in our community, and we created a vision for that. In order to implement it, though, we had the capacity in the community to do that. We partnered with the Port Authority, and through the Port Authority's ability to assemble the site, to do the cleanup, to negotiate with the railroad and other property owners, we now have a wonderful business center in the center of our community, and it's helping to spur other development in the area. And I just want to say that from a community perspective, we couldn't have implemented our community vision without the help of the Port Authority on this matter.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Carlson. Don't see Mr. Carlson. Miles Seppelt. And then after Mr. Seppelt, Jeff Eaton, Pat Mesha, and Tom Deans. Mr. Seppelt, good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Miles Seppelt. I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of Hutchinson, and I'm here on behalf of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, and that's an association of over 500 public and private economic development professionals from throughout the state. And I'm here to express our concerns over the proposed changes to the eminent domain law, specifically how those proposals would affect the use of eminent domain for redevelopment purposes. As written, the rules that I've seen set an extremely high bar for what would be considered a blighted area. One of the requirements is that more than 50% of the buildings in an area would have to be dilapidated, and then it sets forth the criteria for what dilapidated is. Yesterday I sat down with our building inspector in Hutchinson, and I went over the rules with him, and he mentioned to me that he has not seen anything that would meet that criteria in his whole career. The basically it would mean that the building would have to be falling down before it would be considered dilapidated. And he pointed out, and I believe correctly, that real estate is simply too valuable to allow to deteriorate to that condition. No property would meet those criteria that a person would still pay taxes on. So, and then he went on to say that he could not imagine a neighborhood that would meet the criteria, much less 50% of the properties within a particular neighborhood. So it was his opinion, and we concur, that the bar for what is blighted and what is dilapidated is so high that it is not workable. Just to give you an example, I believe they've been handed out, but here in Hutchinson we have a couple buildings right on Main Street. There's a gas station, and then there's a pawn shop next to it. Under the rules that are proposed, they would not be considered dilapidated properties. They could stay there in perpetuity, theoretically. And they're not being used. They're just abandoned, basically abandoned buildings that the owner has no desire to do anything with. If you go to the second page here, I have an illustration. There's an aerial photo of a downtown redevelopment that we did back in 1991 and 1992, when four square blocks of downtown Hutchinson were redeveloped. This included over 45 lots and many owners. But under the proposed rules for what is blight, this project would not have happened. I need to point out, I guess, that this part of Hutchinson is right next to the river. It was the oldest part of the community. It was the area that the settlers first settled in back in the 1850s when Hutchinson was first settled. So as a result, it had a collection of some of the oldest buildings in town and many obsolete uses, many economically obsolete properties. And our redevelopment would not have happened under the rules that are being proposed. On the next page, you can see this here's kind of an earlier view. This was an aerial view that was taken back in 1991-92. And I listed out all the different properties that were there. And then I compared that to what's there today. You know, instead of a collection of old decaying buildings, we have a new Wells Fargo Bank, a Shopko and Econo Foods, along with parks and a trail along the river. And it's a benefit to the entire community. And I would point out that the businesses involved, most of those relocated to other parts of the community, so they're still there. Another concern is that, or another point that we want to bring out, I guess, is that eminent domain is really needed to ensure good faith negotiations. I made an illustration. If we're trying to put together, say, a dozen properties for redevelopment purposes, and one or two property owners arbitrarily decide that even though their property is appraised at $99,000, for example, if they arbitrarily decide that because we want it or because someone else is on the other side of the check,
wrap up, please,
that their property is worth $1 million, then the project stops. And if we don't have eminent domain, we have no recourse to make redevelopment projects happen. So just in conclusion, I want to point out that the current rules are very, very restrictive, and it would lead to a case where we would see urban sprawl with new development happening on the outside of the communities, and the inner core of our communities would decay. Thank you very much.
Members, I'd note as well that I've gone through the list and some people, for whatever reason, haven't been available. I'll circle back around one more time when we get through the list. So if you found out that your name was called and you were on a nicotine break or something, I'll come back through for you. Heroin, I mean, whatever. Proceeding, Mr. Eaton, good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We appreciate this opportunity to come before you to discuss this proposed legislation. I'm Jeff Eaton, Executive Vice President with United Properties. I'm here today as the volunteer president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Association for Office and Industrial Properties. We are a national trade organization for the commercial real estate industry. We represent owners and investors, developers, and various industry professionals. Our Minnesota members own or manage about 160 million square feet of commercial property, housing over 8,500 individual businesses and nearly 300,000 employees. We do not support this bill as it's currently drafted. We are, however, in favor of improving the existing eminent domain law by applying a number of principles that we'd like to share with you today. And I think that this was included in your packet, a small brochure that states those principles. Rather than expanding on those here, I'm going to ask my colleague, Pat Masha, to walk us through the bill and how our principles apply. Pat?
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Masha. I am a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Chapter of NAIOP. In addition, I am in charge of the Twin Cities operations of Duke Realty Corporation. Duke is the largest office and industrial REIT in the country, and we have a substantial local presence. In the Twin Cities, we own over 5 million square feet of commercial space, and we control land positions to permit the development of an additional 5.5 million square feet of commercial space. Like the NAIOP constituency, as an owner-developer, we see the eminent domain issue from both perspectives. My role today is to comment on certain of the proposed bill specifics and describe NAIOP's guiding principles on those issues. As Jeff mentioned, while we support certain improvements to eminent domain and applaud any effort to soften this bill, we do not support this bill because in many instances we believe that this bill goes too far. We have little time, so I'll address a few specific provisions to illustrate our point. First of all, Section 5, dealing with the standard of review. This section would establish a clear and convincing evidence standard and de novo Court of Appeals review. As Representative Johnson mentioned, this is a big change to existing law. As described in NAIOP Principle Number 2, we oppose Section 5 because we believe that it would effectively take control away from the local jurisdictions that should have control over these issues and encourage judicial activism on these issues. Secondly, Section 2, Subdivision 11. This provision would severely restrict the use of eminent domain for all purposes, and especially its use for economic development purposes. Under NAIOP Principles Number 6 and 10, we oppose this provision because we believe it would overly restrict a valuable tool that is sometimes necessary to prevent urban sprawl and correspondingly urban decline. Additionally, as Lori Lauder pointed out, when this tool is used correctly, it can help communities correct blight, reinvent themselves, expand their tax base, and create new jobs. Section 2, the definitions. These provisions would apply a bright line standard to environmental contamination and the definition of blight. We oppose these provisions because we believe that overly stringent definitions effectively take away the flexibility that local jurisdictions need to implement carefully considered and approved local plans. Again, I point to NAIOP provisions number 6 and 10. Finally, sections 4, 6, 7, and 8. These sections address compensation. We support the right of a property owner to receive fair compensation and reimbursement of reasonable expenses, especially when a lowball offer is made by a condemning authority. However, we do not want to encourage additional litigation. Therefore, a local municipality should have a similar reimbursement right if a property owner makes an unreasonable demand or an unreasonable challenge to an action of the local authority. NAIOP Principles Number 8 and 9. Finally, Minnesota eminent domain law has been unchanged for over 40 years. The Kelo decision did not change Minnesota law. It merely affirmed what's already been in place. And although there have been isolated incidents that have received public attention when the use of eminent domain and its practice and its procedures has been challenged, we are not aware of any pattern of abuse by condemning authorities. But we do believe the law can be improved. But we can't tip the scale too far. And in many respects, we believe this legislation goes too far and, in essence, is an illustration of swatting a mosquito with a sledgehammer. So we encourage you to address this issue carefully and make sure that as we work on improving the law and tipping the balance, that we don't tip it back too far the other way. Thank you.
Mr. Mesher, Mr. Eaton, thank you for taking time today to come down and address the committee. Mr. Deans, then Mayor Reitz from Austin, Mayor Applekowski, and then after that, Mayor Jacobs. Mr. Deans, good afternoon.
My name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel to the School Board Association. School districts acquire properties for school use and for future school sites. They condemn easements when they're necessary. We don't, in the course of our condemnation authority, condemn property for economic development or redevelopment purposes, and I'm not going to speak to those provisions. However, the rest of the Act would still apply to our normal condemnation actions that we occasionally end up having to get into. And I believe that the author clearly stated that taking of land for school sites and that was a public use. But when we get to the end, I guess I would like him to reaffirm that on the record, because these are the kinds of things that you get held up and then you end up having to litigate whether this language that says possession, occupation, ownership, and enjoyment of the land by public agencies means taking of a school site by a school district. The author's intention, I think, is clear that that is what it means, that they can take sites, they can take buildings, they can take easements. Cities can acquire land for city halls and for fire halls and those kinds of things. If it's clearly on the record, that would be very helpful to us. In the attorney's fees section, we think that there's a procedural glitch that's in here. This is in this 20% language that was raised before. If the damage or award exceeds 20%, or is 20% greater than the last written offer of compensation made by the condemning authority prior to the filing of the petition. Now, we have to give them our appraisal prior to filing the petition. Then they have a time period when they can go out and get their own appraisal, and if they do it, we have to pay some money for that. We may never have received their appraisal back by the time the actual petition gets filed. If we had made an offer of $100,000 and they came with an appraisal that said $200,000 and we'd already filed the petition, there's nothing we can do, even if we can get them to agree later on. Why would they do that when now they're going to pick up their attorney's fees during the thing? The prior to the filing of the petition language is the problem. Also, the compensation for the going concern provisions that are in Section 6, it's not clear whether that compensation award is included in that 20% or not.
Wrap up, please.
And if it is, we don't know what those numbers are. They are not required to tell us that prior to our filing the petition. Last point is on the minimum compensation thing. If we have it talks about purchasing a similar house or building of equivalent size. If we end up having to condemn an older farmhouse, say 3,000, 4,000 square feet, and we have to give them enough to purchase a similar house or building of equivalent size. The only house or building of equivalent size could cost $400,000 in that community today. That was a 75-year-old house. The ones that are available that are that same size could cost substantially more today. We think you need to work on that similar house or building language so that it has some meaning, because it will be litigated. Once again, we do eminent domain only for traditional functions. We think that those functions should be exempted from these new provisions of this act, the attorney's fees provisions and that. We don't think that's the issue that this bill is trying to address. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Mayor Reitz. Good afternoon, Mayor. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. I'm Bonnie Reitz, Mayor of the City of Austin and also President of the League of Minnesota Cities Board. Thank you, Chair De La Forest and members of the committee. I come before you to raise strong concerns about House File 2846, the eminent domain proposal supported by the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association and the Institute for Justice, a Washington-based special interest group that recently opened an office in Minnesota. Over the past few months, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Kelo case has prompted intense discussion about the use of eminent domain. Even though the Kelo decision did not change the ability of Minnesota governments to use eminent domain, public support exists for some sort of eminent domain reform. However, we believe that House File 2846 represents an extreme reaction to Kelo that would curtail city's efforts to address local priorities, such as eliminating blighted conditions, building affordable housing and housing for seniors, cleaning up polluted land, and boosting economically distressed areas. The great majority of Minnesota cities have not had to use eminent domain for economic development or redevelopment in the past few years. Most don't anticipate using eminent domain for such purposes in the near future. But those cities that have needed to use eminent domain, primarily for redevelopment projects, know it is a tool that must be retained and not merely in name only, as would happen under House File 2846. They have found that sometimes the only way to address community concerns about blight and contamination is through eminent domain. No city official wants to use eminent domain. It is something we work very hard to avoid using. But when all other avenues are exhausted, we have to do what is right for our communities. It's what we're elected to do. We believe that House File 2846 overreaches in many ways. In a few moments, Tom Grunhofer, the League's General Counsel, will talk more about the concerns that we have that are specific to the purview of this committee. Some of the most troubling aspects of the bill include the following. Under the bill, cities could use eminent domain only to eliminate structures that are unfit for human habitation, something almost never seen in Minnesota. Under the bill, the threshold for what constitutes environmental contamination is so high that most of the contaminated sites of concern to neighboring residents and businesses would not qualify. And under the bill, local legislative decisions would shift to the courts. This bill essentially gives no weight to the decisions of local elected officials and raises a standard of review to clear and convincing evidence, an unprecedented standard. As an alternative to this approach, we are calling for responsible eminent domain that balances the needs of individual property owners with the livability of our communities. To this end, the League of Minnesota Cities has worked with other local government groups to develop a proposal that better achieves this balance. Our proposal, House File 2895, directly addresses the
concerns. Mayor, if we could wrap up, please.
Yes, it directly addresses the concerns raised by the Kelo decision and strengthens accountability in the eminent domain process. So thus, we are here today opposing the bill because, as local officials, we are elected to be both responsive and responsible. We urge you, our fellow elected officials, to do the same. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Applekowski. And I said after that, Mayor Jacobs, then Mr. Grunhofer, and then Mr. Mandeshai.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Afternoon,
Chair
Mayor.
And committee members. My name is Beverly Applekowski. I'm a small business owner, and that business happens to be Lakeside Homes, Inc., which is a manufactured housing community in New Brighton. It is probably a poster child for any eminent domain kind of thing. It's one of the endangered species of the housing industry. I am the mayor of Arden Hills. I am on the LMC board. I'm currently the president of the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, and I am the immediate past president of the Ramsey County League of Local Governments. Therefore, I've talked to a lot of people in a lot of cities about a lot of things, and I am here today to talk about eminent domain. Here are a few of the facts that have brought me to this side of the table. The Kelo versus the New London, Connecticut case did not expand eminent domain authority in Minnesota. Minnesota cities use eminent domain very sparingly and as a last resort, and overwhelmingly for traditional public uses such as roads or utilities or schools. The primary but not exclusive users of eminent domain for subsequent private development are the core cities, the inner rib suburbs, and the older metro area cities. The primary use of eminent domain is for the revitalization activities, including blight removal and contamination cleanup. And many eminent domain actions are non-controversial and initiated in order to arrive at an agreeable purchase price or provide the seller with a federal tax break. The Twin Cities metro area enjoys a nationally recognized reputation for being very livable, And that reputation is in part due to its economically, socially, and cultural vital urban core. If you can, please imagine the Twin Cities without a Medtronic, the U.S. Bank, or the Target Center, or the Lawson Software, and others like it. Eminent domain was not used on any of these projects, but all are examples of redevelopment that will be at risk if we effectively eliminate the tool for redevelopment. Now let me offer a few of my own opinions. Supporters of the principal anti-eminent domain bill overstate the eminent domain problem in Minnesota in order to overreach for their solution. While eminent domain may be a little bit bent and a little bruised, it is not broken and consequently does not need a radical fixing. But if the legislature insists on creating a more restrictive eminent domain statute, a reasonable compromise would include the characteristics described by others, as you have heard today already. Since I have been the mayor of Arden Hills, or even before that, the city has not used eminent domain for redevelopment. That has been our choice. Other cities have used eminent domain for redevelopment, and that is, and should be, their choice. As elected city officials, we should continue to have the freedom to make those choices, and we will be held accountable by our voters for the decisions that we make. Most importantly, I ask that you take time to thoughtfully and fully discuss this critical issue with city counterparts. The eminent domain issue should be decided on fact and not fervor. Thank you very much for your time. The handout is a request from the City of Columbia Heights, which has an issue on the blight definition of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor. That's been handed out, has it not, Mr. Verdon? Okay, members, you should have the document Mayor Applekowski refers to. Mayor Jacobs.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to address the committee here this afternoon. I came here as well. I very much share, in my opinion, the comments of the previous two mayors that have spoken.
Mayor Jacobs, you identify yourself.
I'm sorry, I'm Jeff Jacobs, the mayor of St. Louis Park. I agree with the previous speakers in their assessment of this bill. I mean, I came here today to urge the committee to go slow on this and to consider the implications of a bill like this before simply passing it on. I understand that there have been some abuses of eminent domain in the past, but my commentary would be to simply to deal with those abuses straight up. Please, please don't legislate general solutions to specific problems. The issue I know has garnered a considerable amount of press in the public, and this is a complicated issue. It's not simply about private property rights, as the committee is now getting a good sense of this. This is about economic redevelopment and revitalization. It is about the rights of Minnesota communities to reinvent themselves, to redevelop their main streets, and to retain and attract businesses that will come to their communities. Representative Johnson, I think, is right about one thing. It should be difficult for communities to use eminent domain for economic development purposes, but you know what? It is. It is already difficult to do that. And as some of the previous speakers have alluded to, it is only used very, very sparingly. It is used very conservatively, and it is a difficult process to go through. You do not use eminent domain until you have gone through months of public process to determine, first of all, what you want to develop, how you want to develop it, and if you're doing it right, you very much invest the community at large into that discussion and into that decision. I will tell you, in fact, we even get requests by landowners who are asking us to use eminent domain as a way of getting certain tax advantages. We have a situation like that in St. Louis Park right now, where we are, in fact, attempting to redevelop an environmentally blighted piece of property that may or may not meet the definition under the proposed bill, but for which the landowner has actually asked us to give them a letter threatening eminent domain in order to get a certain tax advantage through some federal tax provisions. Let me tell you two stories that pertain very much to St. Louis Park. We are, as you know, St. Louis Park is a first-ring Minneapolis suburb. We have aging infrastructure, aging buildings, and we are very much in need of redevelopment all the time. Economic redevelopment for us is the catchword. Without it, we will fail. Our biggest project that we've undertaken, and we have many in the works already, is Excelsior and Grand. Excelsior Boulevard, as you know, is kind of for St. Louis Park, Excelsior Boulevard is kind of the functional equivalent to the Volga River. Right? It is our main street. It is our main area in town, and over the course of about the last 10 years, we redeveloped it using a number of public processes, and we needed eminent domain in order to make that happen. It was a very complicated project with a multitude of small parcels. We needed to be able to accumulate those parcels, hold on to them in order to do the redevelopment project. The developers all told us they needed a critical mass. They couldn't do it piecemeal, and in fact, we needed the eminent domain tool in order to make that happen. If we had had in place the definition of blight or even of environmental blight in the proposed bill, Excelsior and Grand, I can just tell you right now, would not have happened. It would certainly not have been. Thank you. It would certainly not have happened in the way in which it was, arose, or where you find it today, and it may not have happened at all. So I share the comments and the concerns about a number of the speakers here. I think this bill goes way too far, and it ends up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I leave it to you. I know that you are the gatekeepers of rationality in the state. I urge you to go slowly on this. Think about it. Think about the implications for it. Be careful. You know, God punishes us by granting us what we want. So be careful what you ask for. You might get it. Thank you very much.
Mayor, thank you.
Okay. Yes. Oh, sit down.
So Mr. Grunhofer's here, then Mr. Mandescheid, then Mr. Noonan, and then Mr. Packard after that. Mr. Grunhofer, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Grunhofer, League General Counsel. Since the beginning of our country, governments, federal, state, and local, have the power to acquire property for redevelopment and economic development purposes, really to achieve the greater public good. In Minnesota, the power of government, both state and local, to acquire property for redevelopment and economic development has existed for years. One of the reasons we have the quality of life that we do in this state is that because the state legislature has empowered state and local governments to undertake measures to improve distressed areas to promote economic development. Governor Pawlenty's own bonding bill this year provides $65 million. He's asking for $65 million for economic development efforts at the local level. The recent Jobs Z initiatives passed by this legislature are further indication of the importance that this legislature puts on economic development efforts. With respect to local government's authority to do redevelopment is found in 469. You'll find in that statute that has existed for years the power to acquire property in order to promote jobs, eliminate blight, eliminate environmental conditions, and to promote affordable housing. These powers and the exercise of these powers are the main reasons why you don't see the type of urban decay that we see in other cities around this country. These powers and the exercise of these powers are the reasons that our first-ring suburbs and core cities have been able to revitalize themselves to make them good places to live, work, and recreate. It's important to keep in mind, and this is the main point I want to make, that eminent domain is not an end in itself. It's the power of eminent domain is simply a means to achieve some pretty important goals. No city official wants to take someone's property, but the reality is that without the tool, a single property owner could, in essence, veto a government project that has been declared necessary by elected representatives and which is supported by neighbors and perhaps the community as a whole. At the very least, it gives the property owner the ability to hold the project hostage. It's really disingenuous to focus this debate solely on the eminent domain tool. It is imperative that the legislature have a frank discussion about what the effect of limiting eminent domain will do on the ability of cities to achieve the public policy goals historically served by the tool. The bill plainly prohibits the use of eminent domain for economic expansion. It prohibits the use of eminent domain to promote housing. And despite what the proponents will tell you, it all but eliminates the tool for remediating contaminated properties or to alleviate blight. Again, remarkably, all this comes in response to a court decision that did not create new law and in the context of a statute that has worked fairly well for 50 years. House File 2846 really does represent, as the prior mayor mentioned, a case of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The League urges the committee to consider seriously the implications of the bill and focus discussion rather on the impact the bill will have on some of these important government purposes that are furthered by it. Frankly, that debate has never taken place, and I think it needs to take place. I just want to finish by referencing a piece that we had in our packets. It's a report that was filed just yesterday with the by the Fitch Financial Agency that expressed this observation. It says, eminent domain powers are restricted to a significant degree. If eminent domain powers are restricted to a significant degree, Fitch Rating believes municipal credit quality could be restrained or negatively affected. Moreover, Fitch believes that the restrictive legislation has the potential to contribute to diminution of credit quality over a longer term, in that the proposed laws limit state or local government's ability to respond to economic flight or weakened conditions. That's an objective view from the Fitch agency that just came out yesterday. It's in your packet. I was going to talk about standard review, but since Mr. Manischide will cover that, I will let that go. Suffice it to say that the clear and convincing standard is an open invitation to courts to basically substitute their judgment for that of local governments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grothofer. Mr. Manischide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mark Manderscheid. I'm an attorney in private practice. I have represented the St. Paul Housing and Redevelopment Authority, the St. Paul Port Authority, the Bloomington HRA, the Brooklyn Center EDA, and the MCDA, all in cases where the right to take was challenged. I've even represented the City of Roseau when someone challenged their right to site a city hall. Let me tell you that the bill you have before you represents a radical and significant departure from the way Minnesota has dealt with eminent domain law over the last several decades. If what you desire to do is to prevent a kilo-type taking in Minnesota, it's very simple. You repeal Minnesota Statutes 469.124. It is the only statute that allows takings for economic development. Now, however, we're going to talk about redevelopment. The HRA statute in this state was enacted in 1947. Essentially, its power of eminent domain and its definition of blighted properties has remained unchanged since that time. We have 59 years of history with this bill. It is a statute which has been unanimously upheld as being constitutional by our state Supreme Court numerous times. The definition of dilapidated building does not happen. I can tell you that if this bill passes, you will essentially put out of business every HRA. In all of the projects I have been involved with, none of them would meet this standard. When you get to environmental contamination, let's understand that we all have to deal with another law. It's called the law of gravity. Contamination goes down because gravity pulls it down. It doesn't spread out. A 50% surface area to determine environmental contamination, frankly, it's stupid. I've never seen a property in the projects I've been involved with which would meet that standard where the contamination is a liquid because liquids go down. The doctrine of unintended consequences would hit you here very hard in that you would eliminate the St. Paul Port Authority's ability to deal with environmental contamination because this definition doesn't work. Let me go on to attorney's fees. I'm actually in favor of the second clause here. I think if someone challenges eminent domain and they win, they should be able to get their attorney's fees. That's an oversight in Minnesota law today, so that clause should stay. If you don't know how the real world happens, you should understand that most private property owners are represented by attorneys who are on a contingent fee basis. They get one-third of the money. Because of that, they tend to use a small cadre of appraisers who always come in with much higher numbers. If you are concerned about doctors in personal injury cases who always come up with permanent partial disabilities in large numbers, there are appraisers who do the same thing. I'm not opposed to attorney's fees, but it is something that should kick in only after the commissioners have had a first shot at trying to decide a number. Otherwise, the unintended consequence of what you do here is no property owner will negotiate. Currently, they're not required to provide any information because if they don't negotiate, they fall into this key. Second, it should be the sort of a thing that looks at
Wrap
both
up,
sides.
Please.
If a property owner comes in and says, my property's worth $1 million, and the government says, no, it's $200,000, the fee shifting should only come in if the number is more than $600,000, splitting the difference. Last comment on compensation for loss of going concern. There is nothing in the nation which is like this bill on loss of going concern. Minnesota case law already allows for loss of going concern. In nowhere else in the civil law is the burden of proof shifted so that the party seeking damages did not have to prove their case. This is without precedent in American jurisprudence. I hardly think that Minnesota wants to be the first to establish that type of standard. If you want to make changes, there are certainly some changes you can make and you should look at doing. This bill, drafted by the Institute for Justice, is an ideologically driven bill that simply will not work in the courts in the state, and it will lead to more litigation, not less.
Mr. Noonan. Good afternoon, Mr. Noonan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Noonan. I'm the chair of Government Relations Committee with the Builders Association of Minnesota. And I'm also the division president of Toll Brothers, which is a national home builder operating in 20 states. I'm speaking today on behalf of the members of BAM, the 4,500 firms that build throughout the state and who are responsible for 80% of the homes that are built on a yearly basis. In recognition of the time, I'm only going to talk about definitions. However, I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the need for fundamental reform on some of the procedural elements associated with eminent domain. I think the bill is on the right track, and we certainly look forward to the opportunity to engage in further discussions with respect to language to advance further reform. Eminent domain remains an option available to local governments and other public agencies under the rarest of circumstances. It is truly a remedy of last resort and pursued when all other options have been exhausted. The use of eminent domain, I would submit, is not something that is decided upon by taking authority in the darkest of night, but is rather debated by local government in the face of redevelopment plans under active consideration. It has been my experience as an urban planner, a land developer, a builder, and an observer of local government that eminent domain provides a valuable tool for the revitalization and redevelopment of areas of cities. In many instances, there is an economic development aspect associated with redevelopment schemes, and it's impossible to parse redevelopment from economic development. This has been positively witnessed throughout Minnesota and throughout the nation. I believe that it would be poor public policy to move forward with legislation that would effectively eliminate the eminent domain tool. It is difficult enough already to advance redevelopment with the tools that presently exist. To take one further implement out of the toolbox further ties the hands of parties that are looking to redevelopment, most often on urban infill sites that are obsolete and oftentimes impaired one way or another. The proposed legislation simply goes too far in limiting the use of eminent domain. Definitions are proposed, which I submit would be difficult to meet. The upshot of these narrowly conceived definitions is that eminent domain would cease to exist insofar as redevelopment is concerned. Why is this a concern? With the greater push to grow in and not grow out, tools such as eminent domain are needed to bring about redevelopment plans of cities. It is clearly in the public interest to propose the revitalization of functionally and economically obsolete areas. Plans of this sort are not hatched overnight, but are born out of collective interest to do something positive, are conceived in plans that are thoughtful, well-reasoned, and of a benefit to a city and its citizens, are open and thoroughly debated in public forums, and are decided upon by municipalities' democratically elected councils. Eminent domain is used in the rarest of situations where the plans of the public are threatened by one individual to hold a societal benefit hostage and to deal with demands which are excessive and unsubstantiated. The Builders Association is encouraged by the bills that are put on the table, and we look forward to the opportunity to craft legislation which reforms eminent domain and does so in a meaningful way that provides for the benefits which are there for the collective, which are there for the collective good. Thank you.
Mr. Packard. After Mr. Packard, that is the end of the batting order, and we'll go up and see if the three people from before have arrived and care to testify. Mr. Packard, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's tough being number 20 on a list of 20. My name is Rick Packer. I'm the chair of the Public Policy Committee for the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. I have been a city planner for 10 years. I am recovering. I'm on step number 11 of 12. I was one of the dreamers that I think you hear a lot of people complain about in this issue. I've been a real estate developer for the last 25 years, and I was also on the Metropolitan Council for 5 years under Governor Carlson. I have seen the topic of eminent domain from both sides of the table. I want to just tell you three things this afternoon very quickly. First of all, builders by the, and developers by their very nature are property rights advocates, and we applaud Mr. Johnson in trying to shed some light and make some changes on this very tough issue. There's not a day that goes by that we don't go into our offices and are approached by one type of government agency of one size or shape or another, and they want something that I have, and that's my land. And they have a dream, and like it or not, I am in it. We call it by a different name than eminent domain. We call it dedication and exactions and for the good of the community. But nevertheless, there are people with dreams that I have to fulfill. But we are also businessmen doing in the city business in the cities and towns throughout Minnesota. And it is imperative that these cities are able to renew themselves, to revitalize themselves, and assist in economic development. That is one of the serious flaws we see in this bill. It makes that so tight that we think economic development and redevelopment will become a non-factor. And it would be a shame to see all of the other things, good things that this bill does, be irrelevant because it just simply won't be used. Secondly, with respect to compensation, we like many of the aspects that this bill has with respect to compensation. We think that's something that's been lacking in eminent domain for a long time. There should not be caps on what kinds of appraisals property owners should get. There should not be caps on the going concern or relocation costs. They are what they are. They should be determined by the appraisals and then by the courts if that can't be resolved in those matters. But we practice the mantra of no harm, no foul, and that begs then for more fair compensation to property owners when eminent domain is being used. Lastly, with respect to the process, we like the light that it sheds on this process. Property owners should have every ability available to them that the agency who is condemning their property has. It's as simple as that. And we like the way that this bill goes about that. The Builders Association of the Twin Cities thinks there are very positive things about this bill. Its impact on redevelopment and revitalization, I think, needs to be reevaluated. But we look forward to working on this issue in the coming weeks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll go back as Mayor Skogquist arrived. Okay. Going once. How about Mayor Longry? All right, I see Mr. Carlson's here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for accommodating my absence when you originally called me. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association, which consists of five counties here in the Twin Cities area, and soon to be eight counties in greater Minnesota. I want to speak specifically to the effects that this bill will have on transportation infrastructure and transportation funding issues. Section 2 of the bill, perhaps raises issues due to the recodification of what constitutes public use, in that it requires that the property that's acquired for traditional purposes be possessed, occupied, owned, and enjoyed by the general public or by public agencies. With that sort of definition, the question arises, and we're certain it will be litigated, if we're doing an improvement that at the initial point of time benefits one property. Say, for example, we're building an interchange that's the result of a large office complex or a shopping center being built up. And we have to take a property that exists on that corner of that property to build that interchange or to put in the turn lanes, whatever safety features we think is necessary to serve the public at large. Will the individual have a cause of action to say, this in fact does not serve the general public, it only serves that one property? With this language, we're almost certain that we will get those sort of lawsuits. Going on to Section 4, the attorney's fees provisions, we're certain that it's going to increase our costs of acquisition substantially. In Florida right now, which has some of the most liberal attorney fee reimbursement policies in the nation, for every $1 or for every $5 that's spent for actual right-of-way and damages, over $1 is spent for attorneys and other expert fees. We would hate to see a situation like that occur in Minnesota. We're also certain, as I think has already been referenced by other testifiers, it's going to substantially slow down the process because we're basically going to have attorneys approaching all affected owners and say, I'll get you 20% or you won't have to pay me a dime, since 20% is the threshold. So right now, where we're able to negotiate and ultimately agree with nearly 90% of our the properties that we're acquiring from owners on average, we're certain that that will go down. The 20% threshold may seem high, but the reality is it is not. Right now, for taxes payable in 2006, property values statewide have gone up nearly 13%. Certain classes of property have gone up over 20%. You contrast that with the fact that at the time from when is the latest point in which we can offer a written offer under this bill, the time when we file the petition and to when the condemnation commissioners give their award, which is frequently up to 18 months and in some instances has been as long as 10 years, it's easy to see that we could breach that threshold. The same is true with what is our most common taking, what we refer to as a strip taking, or say we require just the 17 front footage of a lot to expand a road to contemporary standards. Frequently, the amount of compensation we give is relatively nominal, $5,000, $10,000 for that, say if it's a residence in a rural or exurban area. It would just take, if that was a $5,000 compensation, increasing the compensation by just $1,000, and we've hit that 20%, and we'll have to pay hundreds of dollars of attorney's fees in addition. The other provision that I want to mention is the going concern provision. I want to make it clear that what we provide right now by statute is compensation for bricks and mortar, the land and the buildings. But we do pay going concern value under the case law. If we acquire property, say it's a bar, and they cannot relocate because of restrictions on liquor license elsewhere in the community, we pay for the value of the business. So it's not as if it's not occurring right now. In addition, we pay substantial relocation benefits to both the owners and the tenants of those properties. And for particularly businesses, we pay up to $50,000 of reestablishment expense, which includes advertising the new location, up to $2 million
of
increased operating expenses, rent, taxes, insurance, and utility charges, or if the owner or tenant elects, we'll pay them an in lieu payment of up to $20,000. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. What we'll do is we'll move on to consider Representative Ellison's amendment. Then we will entertain any questions either for the author or any of the witnesses we've heard from, and then we will give the chairman the last word. I imagine he might have a couple words in rebuttal to some of the witnesses we've heard today. Representative Ellison, I believe the A8 amendment is yours.
That's Mr. Chair, that's right. Thank you for recognizing me in this amendment.
Yep. Representative Ellison moves the A8 amendment. For the record, Representative Ellison, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment speaks to the standard of proof which the taking authority, the condemning authority, would have to show in order to prevail on a taking in the case where you have those four enumerated things: environment, dilapidated housing, and there's a couple of others that are listed there, and I think you know what I'm referring to. And the reason I offer this amendment, Mr. Chair, is because I could find really very, very few places in American law where clear and convincing evidence is applied to a civil case. Generally, clear and convincing is you can find that if somebody is up for being revoked from probation in the criminal context. Clear and convincing evidence. And you can find clear and convincing evidence usually when there is some individual liberty issue. And I'm not talking about dollars and cents. I'm talking about you being someone perhaps being sent to being involuntarily medicated in the psych, or somebody being
put into a commitment, something in that environment. But almost all of American law says that when we're dealing with something essentially civil, that we apply the civil standard, and that's by the preponderance of the evidence. And I mean, a few people in today said that, you know, this is a radical departure. And I think that there are some good things about this bill, Mr. Chair and the author. I think that there's, you know, there are some things that are good about this bill, but I think this is one of the things that is simply going to grind development to a halt. And, you know, I come from an urban district. We have houses that we need redevelopment in my district. We can't simply just, say that we can't stop eminent domain, because essentially it would just perpetuate slum areas, actually. But I think that it makes it fairer if we just do it the way we do it in every other aspect of the civil law and take the standard to clear and convincing. So that's my amendment. Stand for any questions about it, and hope you support it.
Thank you, Representative Ellison. Any questions for the author of the amendment? Representative Johnson, do you have any comments with respect to the A8 amendment?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I don't support the amendment. And this is actually an issue that I have thought about considerably. And a couple months ago, I actually asked one of our research folks to take a look at the issue of where do we find clear and convincing evidence, because it is a high standard. I mean, you're absolutely right about that, Representative Ellison, and I don't claim that it's not. And they found 147 instances of clear and convincing evidence standard being invoked in Minnesota statutes. Now, a majority of those are in the criminal law, as you mentioned yourself, but there are many in the civil context. They say approximately 20% of those, so at least, well, it sounds like at least 30 different instances. And I asked for some of the most interesting examples of that, and the three that were given is that Minnesota Statute 214.106 requires that boards governing health-related licenses can only revoke such licenses based on a complaint of fraud upon a showing of such fraud by clear and convincing evidence. So that protects health care providers from essentially frivolous complaints of fraud. MnStat 554.02, which is known as the Anti-Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, or SLAP, statute. And this is the hypothetical that's given. A community activist gets sued by a private party for interfering with its economic expectancy. The activist, under the anti-SLAP statute, can move to dismiss the lawsuit on grounds of immunity, and the private developer must then prove by clear and convincing evidence that the immunity does not apply. So really, it's protecting community activists against having their free speech chilled, which I think we're talking about a First Amendment right in that case, a Fifth Amendment right in this case. And then the most recent that we could come up with was the bill that we passed last year regarding concealed weapons, Section 658.08, and that states that the sheriff, in order to refuse the issuance of a right to carry permit when sued in mandamus, can only do so if the sheriff can prove certain factors by clear and convincing evidence. So again, that's looking at Second Amendment rights of individuals, and this is looking at the Fifth Amendment rights of individuals. The other example that I didn't even see in here that I can think of, because I was on the conference committee that dealt with this, is 3-4 years ago when we passed the employee reference statute. We said that a former employee can only sue a former employer for sharing certain information with a prospective employer if they can prove by clear and convincing evidence that certain things happened. And I remember we had a long discussion about whether that was too high a standard. And the answer turned out to be no, it wasn't, because we use it in several other instances in Minnesota law. So to me, when you were talking about a person's constitutional right not to have their land taken from them for an improper reason, I think having a high standard that we see in many other places in Minnesota law is a good thing.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I would submit to the committee members that, and let's just keep it real here for a moment. You know, if I heard that the author wants the bill to come out of committee clean, and therefore it's pretty clear how this is going to go if you can count. But the fact is that the author just mentioned about two or three examples But what I'm talking about is the whole of not just Minnesota law, but American jurisprudence that has to do with the civil standard. I'm not talking about some highly political bills that we passed in the last few years. I'm talking about since the formation of this country, we have had a civil standard of preponderance of the evidence in these types of cases. I mean, if you pluck out a couple of examples over the last few years in this politicized environment, sure. I mean, you might be able to, you know, over the concealed carry. That's not the example I would want to use if I wanted to show that this is something that is consistent with American law. So clear and convincing evidence is something that is associated with wrongdoing. You mentioned the fraud example. That's probably not a bad example. That's one example you use that I probably would agree would fit here, because we're talking about quasi-criminal activity when we want to apply that clear and convincing standard. But when we are talking about dollars and cents and property, when we are talking about civil, we are talking in the civil arena, and the standard has been preponderance of the evidence. And, you know, let me just mention, Mr. Chair, that I've been very sympathetic to people who have been arguably abused in the eminent domain procedure. I mean, I heard about the whole thing in Best Buy. I haven't heard both sides of the story, and I don't want to make any decisions about that. But it seemed as though that the aggrieved parties had an argument to make that, hey, we got treated badly here. I'm not taking sides. I just listen. But basically, I've heard about two cases where there's an argument that two individuals were mistreated by eminent domain. And in the face of that, we're going to turn the legal system on its head. And I just hope that, you know, we take a broader look than just this particular legislative session dealing with this particular issue, and just not react to an event that just recently happened, but take a long view. So, Mr. Chair, with that, you know, I can count, so I'm going to withdraw my amendment and offer it later. But no, I don't want to withdraw it now unless other people want to comment on it, Mr. Chair. But I do intend to withdraw it at the end of any dialogue on this, because it's pretty clear how it will go.
Any further discussion with respect to the A8 amendment? Okay, seeing none, then Representative Ellison will withdraw the A8 amendment. Now, a committee discussion with respect to the bill, discussion amongst the committee, questions for the author, or questions for any witness. Representative Broad, I know you wanted to be on the list first.
I did, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I had a question for Ms. Lauder, I think, from the Port Authorities, if she's still here. Oh, okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lauder, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lauder, thank you for your testimony. And I constantly hear a lot about port authorities, and I often think that they should be by water, but often they're not. So I'm wondering what authorities you have as a port authority that HRAs or EDAs don't have, because I'm hearing of port authorities in communities throughout the state, and it just seems like it's a little odd that we're creating another entity on top of the HRAs and the EDAs, and so I guess I'm just wondering if you can help me out with that.
Ms. Lauder.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Rob, I wanted to just indicate we do have water at our port authority. We do manage the St. Paul Harbor. Just wanted to make that clear. That's one of our four lines of business. And also with the caveat that I am not an attorney and don't know the statutes inside and out, I can tell you that the St. Paul Port Authority has the ability to use Chapter 469 and the other EDA statutes kind of all within one. We are structured so that we're very closely aligned with the City of St. Paul in terms of our activities.
Thank you. Representative Slower.
Mr. Chair.
You're on the list.
I am on the list? Well,
do you want to be on the list?
I guess I better ask a question, Mr. Chair. but for the
if your
author.
Name's on the list, I'm calling it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and to the author, I think there's obviously a lot to look at on both sides of this issue, and there's obviously some concerns. What can you explain further what your thinking is on attorney's fees and where you're going with that?
Sure.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Slaway.
number one, I'm willing to talk more on attorney's fees, certainly. And we're willing to talk on all these pieces. Attorney's fees, some people have raised some legitimate considerations and concerns about that. But I do believe that the concept of attorney's fees is really important in this bill, because the situation you have right now is, and I have heard this firsthand from many, many, especially homeowners in Minnesota, and Representative Ellison, it's not just a couple people. There are lots of people that have pretty sad stories to tell. Not thousands. We heard from several of them at the first meeting. I've heard from a lot of folks who say, you know, the government came in to take my property, and I didn't want to leave. You know, this is where I raised my family. I don't want to leave. There isn't a dollar amount that's going to make me happy, but I knew what would happen if I bought it. There's the club of eminent domain out there. And the only way to fight it is to go hire an attorney. Some attorneys do take these on contingent fee basis, and others don't. But bottom line, there is an expense, and in many cases, a very significant expense. And therefore, a lot of people can't afford to challenge it. What this says is not that government is going to give them money to challenge, but if they win, they're going to get their money back, the money that they would have to spend on an attorney. That's the basic concept behind it.
Representative Slawik.
Mr. Chair, you know, some people in looking at that issue might say that if government's coming up with the money, that's really the taxpayers coming up with the money. Sure. And is that really what government should be doing? It's turning back to the taxpayers. It kind of brings full circle some of the rhetoric, you know, in terms of who really should be paying. What are your thoughts on really if you took some of those awards and divided among the population, could consider it maybe a tax increase?
Representative Mr. Chairman, you got two choices. If the government abuses eminent domain, either the person aggrieved, the single landowner, can pay the attorney's fees, or the government, the taxpayers, can pay the attorney's fees. Those are your two choices. You don't have any others. And in my opinion, if the government abuses their power, the property owner should not be alone held responsible for that, especially since the argument is the reason we use eminent domain is for the good of the entire public. So I'm not a fan of attorney's fees, period, as you may have seen in the last couple years in this committee, or the last year in this committee. I generally don't like to see them in bills at all. This one, to me, is a little different than talking about a couple of private entities and allowing one side to get attorney's fees and not the other. This is the power of the government to take someone's property away, and the lack of ability in many cases of individual citizens to fight back. This levels the playing field a little bit, I think.
Thank you. Members, a note, we've got Representative Westrum, then Emmer, then Simon, then Broad. We have exceeded committee time today, obviously, and I think that's okay given the complexity and the importance of this bill, but I would appreciate your cooperation perhaps in getting us to vote no later than about 35 after the hour. Thank you. Representative Westrum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair.
Stay a session already.
Right. Mr. Chair, when you live with three women, that's what you comes out first. first question, just for the author, Representative Johnson, this would only apply the 20%. A standard and the attorney fees would only apply to economic development. As I understand, it doesn't apply to the public use, the highways, the standard.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, Representative Westrum, the attorney fee provision applies to all takings. The elevated standard only applies to the economic development type takings.
Okay.
Representative Westrum.
So we will also be making it, in my estimation, more fair for those property owners who have a highway coming through and are lowballed by a government agency. They would be able to go through the same process of, if they're more than 20% off, receive attorney fees, etc.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And Mr. Chair, I just would think it's time we go down that road, and I applaud you, Representative Johnson, for taking on this bill. I think we've slowly and incrementally gotten away from a tight standard of eminent domain to the point where it's almost a strategic move by government units from time to time when they have no other option or feel they have no other option, but in fact they probably could go and talk to the landowners and work something out ahead of time. And the reason it's particularly key to me is I've seen this even in my district where our own Department of Transportation comes through, and it seems to be a very expensive and litigious process that, you know, if everybody would have just come to the table in good faith up front, you'd save the property owners having to hire attorneys. And the reason they go hire attorneys, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, is because they are so offended by the lowball figure that is often brought to them. And so I think it's a good move for us to be going in this direction. Last comment to Representative Ellison's amendment and comments about it is, you know, maybe this is criminal, taking property and not just taking life and putting somebody in an institution. You're taking them out of their property and putting them somewhere where they don't want to be. So, you know, I would argue this perhaps is criminal as well. But I understand your argument. I think clear and convincing is the way to go.
Representative Westman. Representative Emmer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, staying away from the rhetoric, I have a couple of questions for you about your reasoning. One, you have a provision in the bill that says on appellate review, it will be de novo, meaning that the appellate court will be looking at both the factual determinations as well as the application of the law at the lower court. What's your reasoning? Why do we want to do that all over again?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Representative Emmer and Mr. Chairman, I don't have a strong feeling with respect to that piece, but I would like to call Mr. Lander or Mr. McGrath forward because that particular piece of the bill, I think, may be based upon what we've seen in some other states, possibly.
Good afternoon, Mr. McGrath. Could you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Mr. Chair, I'm Lee McGrath. I'm the Executive Director for the Institute for Justice Minnesota Chapter. And I've been working with Representative Johnson and Senator Bach on some of the constitutional and legal issues associated with this bill. Representative Emmer, whenever a appellate court reviews a case, it reviews the law de novo. There is no question about that. That is the process of an appellate case. And the application of facts found at the lower court. However, in these eminent domain cases, the reason why the bill includes a de novo review of facts is that these cases are particularly fact-intensive. There are questions raised whether this is a public use, whether the project is really blighted, or there is a public nuisance. So any meaningful appellate review does require a review of the facts.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McGrath, well, certainly they'll be able to review the facts, but I'm talking about why we want to essentially, if you're going to have a de novo review of both issues, you're retrying the case at the appellate level. Why do we want to do that? Why don't we pay deference to the fact-finding abilities of the lower court and just allow the appellate court to do what it is the appellate court is supposed to be doing, reviewing application of the law de novo?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, it is the fact intensity of these cases is what warrants redoing the fact finding. You can imagine on issues of formula, on issues of blight finding, on issues of finding of public nuisance, on abandoned property, or that in order for the appellate court to get a true understanding of what happened, it must review. Now, the other important observation is that it is a appellate process that is open to both the plaintiff and the defendant, that should the government want to appeal it too. And so there is symmetry in what happens in the de novo review at the appellate level.
Representative Emmer.
Just a comment and then my next question. Mr. McGrath, I have to be candid with you that doesn't provide me with much comfort. In fact, it's more troublesome to me that we want to, in effect, throw out the lower court's fact-finding ability. This is more troubling to me than Representative Ellison's issues about the burden of proof. Believe me, I can't tell you how many times that I would like to have all of the facts in a case that I've tried re-reviewed at the higher court. And I think one of the reasons we do it the way we do is for closure. And I think that might be important here as well. My next question to Representative Johnson has to do with, I have a problem that this bill doesn't have any reference to the situation that we've had discussions. I think individual representatives have had discussions with different people involved in the process, MnDOT, the auto dealers, the League of Minnesota Cities. It has to do with a public entity purchasing private or condemning private property and then determining at some later point that they don't want it. And there's a disagreement, and I don't see anything in your proposal that addresses this problem as to who gets that equity. A year or two from now, and I heard something just today that a local school district has a piece of property that they've been holding for 30 years. It seems to me that if I'm the private property owner with the Second Amendment rights, and I say to Representative Slawick, we can call it taxpayer money, but we're talking about a constitutional right to hold property, to own and hold property, which is what this country is based on, and we're talking about just compensation, which is what that constitutional provision provides. How is it just when you tell me that by virtue of eminent domain, you're going to take my property, and that at some point in the future you say to me, guess what, we don't need it, we'll sell it back to you. First, you don't have the right of first refusal, which I think we should have to the original property owner. But then who gets that equity? It seems to me that the private property owner is entitled to that equity. And do you intend to address that?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, the private property owner should get the equity, and we haven't addressed that yet. I'm very aware of that, and I've also talked with Representative Broad about that. I think Representative Nelson's bill has something to that effect in his bill as well, and I would like to sit down and talk to people some more, because that is, I agree with you in principle, and certainly is a piece we could add to the bill.
Thanks. Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a comment, I guess with an invitation for a question to either gentleman about the de novo standard. I agree with Representative Emmer that I think it's troubling in the sense that another reason why we don't do de novo review of the facts, but do de novo review of the law, is because the finder of fact at the trial court level can assess credibility. At the trial court, the judge can assess whether someone's lying or sincere or shifty-eyed or authentic. And the cold, hard record that goes up to the appellate court doesn't afford that opportunity. So I would just urge you, as you go on to another committee, if Representative Johnson, you're amenable to that, I think that might be a real common sense sort of change. That would just be my editorial comment. Mr. Chair, a couple questions. I have a question about the use of the term absolute necessity as opposed to necessity. For example, in line 3.21, the section beginning in line 3.21, I notice the use of the term absolutely necessary, and elsewhere in the bill it's just necessity or necessary. Can either of you speak to the need for that, the use of that term here?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, thank you for that question. Language has been distorted in Minnesota case law. Today the term necessary means convenient. And so without the modifier of absolute necessity, you never get to the idea of what necessity really means. It means that there is no other alternative but to take that property. And so when reaching beyond the blighted area, beyond the contaminated area, what the authors wish to do is to limit that reaching power so as to make it only apply to situations in which there is no other alternative, and the way to achieve that the authors settled on, with the advice of Deb Dyson, was to modify it with absolute in front of it.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up on that. Can either of you tell us if there's anywhere else in statute or law where that term is currently used? And I guess an alternative question would be, is there any case law from this jurisdiction or other states that convinces you that that would plug the hole that you see that needs plugging? In other words, if what you say is true about how Minnesota courts have interpreted just the naked word necessary, is there case law from other states that say, yeah, if you add absolutely onto there, then that problem doesn't arise?
I think
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Simon, the goal that the authors had was to limit the power on the non-blighted area. And so instead of choosing the term no other alternative but, what the revisor's office suggested was to use the terminology absolute necessity. I'd be happy to supply to the committee a memo answering more directly, or perhaps Ms. Dyson might speak to where else in Minnesota statutes it applies.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next question has to do with the scope in general of the bill, which obviously encompasses environmental cleanup. I thought I heard the author and others say that the initial impetus for this bill was, frankly, kind of the Best Buy Walzer situation, where it's a private-to-private transfer. Why was the decision made to include environmental contamination and cleanup in this bill if the impetus for the bill was something else?
Mr. Representative Johnson.
Representative Simon, I don't think I ever said that, at least. I think it's fair to say that the Kelo decision got everybody's attention. And it is accurate, by the way. Several people brought up the fact that Kelo didn't really change much, if anything, in Minnesota. They're right. And this is kind of the rules that we've been using for a couple decades in Minnesota. That doesn't mean that it's not wrong. But it wasn't a great departure in Minnesota. So the impetus for fixing things within the eminent domain system was not the problem just of private-to-private takings. It's something broader than that. And the environmental protection piece is simply in there to provide for an exception to the, I don't want to say the word ban, but on the restriction of economic development takings. What we're actually trying to do there is say that if you truly have an environmentally contaminated area, we want you to be able to use eminent domain in those cases. Some people argue that it's too strict. I would disagree with that, but that's why we're here.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. McGrath.
Representative Simon, it is true that the Kelo decision, which my colleagues in Arlington, Virginia, argued on behalf of Suzette Kelo, did not change the law in Minnesota. However, it did a number of things. The Minnesota statutes have had economic development authority. But most municipalities and most takings, including the Walzer taking, was done under blight statutes, because the economic development statutes were untested constitutionally. But the blight, and so the work to only address the economic development issues raised by Kelo is to ignore the reality that here in Minnesota, much of the takings, and I would submit abuses under eminent domain, have been done under the blight statutes.
Representative Simon?
One last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question about line 3.13. I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. It talks about the public use and public purposes. Am I interpreting this correctly or incorrectly to mean that if a public agency wanted to own the property in question once it was converted to the new use, that that would be okay under this definition? So, for example, if the city of St. Louis Park wanted to get into the condo business and actually own the condominium building and run it and operate it, that would be okay.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, that would be my interpretation as well.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, I just want to thank you very much. You've taken on a pretty important issue for the states, and I want to thank you for your thoughtful approach and reasonable approach, and you've been very open in talking with me about some of the concerns. I just wanted to thank you for that. Having said that, there are still things. I don't think the bill is quite there yet. There's still a few concerns that I have regarding the 20% provision on attorney's fees. I do think that there's some good arguments out there on those small partial strip takings at $1,000. I don't know that there's an appraiser out there that's within $200. The concern that could trigger thousands of attorney's fees dollars on top of that, I think, is a fair concern, and I look forward to working with you on that as we move forward. In addition, the appraisal process in terms of transfers of appraisals and the caps on appraisals, I do think is another area that we need to look at, and I look forward to working with you on some of those things. It just seems a little crazy to me that if a unit of government, say the DOT, just to use one, is paying $15,000 for an appraisal, that they're only going to give the private property owner $1,500 for that same appraisal. There's no way that that private property owner is going to get an appraisal for much less than what the government is paying. So I do want to address some of those things as well. But a question now, in regards to the blight. Do you have examples of unfit for human use? Because, I am an appraiser, and just for the record, I don't do appraisals on eminent domain proceedings. But do you have an example? I've been in a lot of houses, and I'm wondering whose standard that is, or if there's case law regarding unfit for human use.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, we do not have any specific examples of case law, and that is something that we will look for if that's helpful.
Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will look forward to working with you. I think that it tightens it up. I think the goal, obviously, is to tighten it up significantly, but my concern is that piece of that section, I'm just not sure what might apply in terms of the use of that language. And then secondly, I guess, or lastly, just to follow up on what Representative Simon said, I'm concerned a little bit that we're inadvertently putting cities or units of government in the business of real estate. If it's okay for them to go in and operate that condo or the multi-use, but it's not okay for them to do a public-private partnership, I'm a little concerned over the inadvertent or unintended results of that. But thank you again for your work. I look forward to working on this a little bit more as we move forward.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to kind of add on to that comment, just to try to get at the definition of blight, I think will be an important discussion as we move forward. And we've been given lots of examples of things that could not possibly be considered blight under this law, and we could not redevelop with calling these buildings blighted. However, in looking at these buildings and these examples, and I'm reading the definition of dilapidated building on page 225, 226, unfit for human use because it is unsafe, structurally unsound, or lacking in basic equipment, I think to say that these buildings would not qualify as blighted buildings would have said that the folks taking these photographs would have gone through these buildings and known that they had not been inspected. I see multiple building code violations and unsafety issues, and I don't know that these would not fit under the definition of blight. And in fact, I think I could make the argument just sight unseen that we probably could. Have you thought about that? Or in earlier testimony in Blaine, that was the reaction that I had gotten in seeing example after example of blight, that I could make the case that that would fit under this.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Dean. I made the same observations with some of the examples, and just from snapping a picture, you can't tell. And I don't think we can just assume that because somebody says, well, this would never have fit under the definition, that that is necessarily true. And remember, it's not just this definition of blight. There's also the exception for a public nuisance, which is something that is essentially creates risks, health risks or safety risks for the general public. And there is the environmental contamination provision in there, and many of the examples that were brought up at this hearing and the last hearing were areas that were environmentally contaminated. Now, some are arguing that because it has to be absolutely necessary to take a non-contaminated piece, that is too strict or too broad. But if there's environmental contamination and it's significant, that exception is still there. So I think that's a fair assessment.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, another perspective to look at this very issue is that what is being considered here today is the takings power. This legislation does not at all represent the powers of the state to regulate, to fine, to fix, to encourage properties to be fixed up. As the Supreme Court said in a case in the 18th century, this is the despotic power, the power of taking. And so this really is a power that should be regarded when there are no other alternatives.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of follow, I think that that's something that we need to work with in going through the bill and just look at what is unsafe or unfit. When we're looking at buildings at the opposite end, when we build them from the ground up, there is a point at which we are issued a certificate of occupancy, which means that the building is fit for the reason that the building was intended to be used. So local municipalities currently say when a building is safe to be occupied and used at the beginning of its life, and I think that now we're sort of looking at it at the opposite end. And so I think a lot of these photographs that we've been giving that are saying they're not dilapidated or they would not fit under blight perhaps do, and I think that that's something folks looking at these photographs need to take into consideration.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative, if I could just add one
Representative
thing.
Representative Johnson.
Keep in mind, governments have the ability to figure out what the market price, the selling price is, too, regardless of their power of eminent domain.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. McGrath, I'm not an attorney. Close as I got is to be fathering of one. But so help me understand this. In your environmentally contaminated area, how do you get to the subdivision 8, number 2, talks about the cost of monitoring, testing, remediation, that sort of stuff. How do you get to that until you've already taken the property and you've started cleaning it up? Help me understand the equation on that, if you would, please.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. In this chapter 2, the purpose of this, the author's purpose of putting this in was to cause the municipality to get appraisals as to what it would cost to remediate such an environmental contamination, and thus to show by clear and convincing evidence that it meets the two prongs, the prongs starting on line 2.29, that there are contaminants, pollutants, on or below the ground, and secondly, that those costs are significant. But once again, I add, this is the power to take. And so the Pollution Control Authority and local equivalents can do many things prior to taking property.
Representative Nelson.
And so, Mr. McGrath, if my understanding is right, then somebody comes into estimate what it will cost, and if that exceeds 100% of the market value of what the assessor has put their property at,
they may take.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. Yes, they may take the property.
And so, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Wouldn't this almost be a given? I mean, an assessor certainly, even on a piece of dilapidated property or property that is evidently contaminated, they're not going to assess the value of that property higher like they would some property that's kept up. I would presume they're going to continually assess at a low value year after year. And so reaching that 100% of the cost could easily be attained.
Mr. McGrath, Representative Nelson, thank you for seeing that. That was the intentions of the author, included the fact that the market value does change and can go down. Your conclusion about this not being a very high hurdle, I think, is consistent with the intention of the authors.
Mr. Chairman, one last one. On the part where you're taking non-dilapidated buildings, wouldn't the same case kind of hold true that an assessor would come in and if my neighbor's property has become a garbage house, or I live with a couple of garbage houses around my property, and even though that I maintain mine just immaculately, that they actually are degrading the value of my house and the entire neighborhood? Explain that for me.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, excuse me. In the question of taking non-dilapidated property, which is next to dilapidated or blighted property, there is no market value test. What protects, we want to protect the neighbor who has kept his property in good condition. The power that the municipality has is to clean up the blighted, the dilapidated property. It can only reach the non-blighted, non-dilapidated property when it shows by clear, the municipality shows by clear convincing evidence that it is absolutely necessary to take the good house, the immaculate house, the house in which the owners have done the right things of keeping it in good condition. Market values don't come into play in that dynamic the way they do in the environmental contamination area.
Representative Nelson.
One last one, I thought I was done before. You brought up that clear and convincing evidence statement again, Mr. McGrath. So if you do take that nice piece of property that was surrounded by blighted, based on clear and convincing evidence, and you prove that to the courts, so does that mean that forever and ever, amen, that property can never go to any private use? It just has to be used for
no
public purpose?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the constitutional requirement of public use is met by the elimination of blight and the taking for blight. Once the property is taken, those houses are destroyed, even the non-blighted one, once they are destroyed, the constitutional requirement has been met. Therefore, the city can redevelop it, can sell it for private commercial development, for housing, for low-income housing, anything it wants, because it is no longer under the under it has already met its constitutional obligation of a public use.
Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I have a question that goes back to the to your amendment earlier regarding Public Service Corporation.
Yes.
Would that definition include what is known currently in law as an innovative energy project, which is included, it's considered a utility as defined in Section 116C.52. I think you know what project I'm, what innovative energy project I'm referring to. Would that be included in this or not?
Representative
Johnson. Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilke, yes, I believe it would.
Members, with that, I don't see anybody else on the list in terms of committee members wishing to ask questions. Therefore, we'll give Representative Johnson a moment to wrap up before we vote. I think it's clear that, as with any major bill and any complex bill, some perhaps infirmities with the bill were brought up today. I would note Representative Emmer and Representative Simon, I would tend to agree with you that with respect to the de novo review, the original finder of fact certainly has access to, you know, indicia of credibility that are unavailable to courts of appellate jurisdiction. But I'm confident that this bill, as it wends its way through the process here in the various committees, some of these things, as Representative Broad said, will be tightened up. And I'm confident that they will be. Representative Johnson, certainly I think you have a good bill overall and an important bill. But with that, we'll let you make final comments here before we vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have about 23 things to say, but I will cross them all out, save for two, that simply refer to a couple of the comments that were made. And one of them was this handout. I can't even remember who handed it out, but on the third page, Hutchinson Downtown Redevelopment, it shows a list of things that back in the early 90s existed there, such as electric, motor rewinding building, auto parts, gas station, grain elevator, beauty salon, in-house, etc. And they were replaced with a Shopko and Econo Foods, a Wells Fargo bank, and parks. And I realize that some people, maybe almost all people, would prefer a Shopko and Econo Foods and a Wells Fargo bank to a gas station and a grain elevator and four old houses and dry cleaners. I'm probably among them. But it doesn't mean that government then ought to be able to force these people out off of their property just because some of us would rather see a big box retailer or something that looks nicer, because it is one of the most fundamental rights we have as Americans, is to own our property without the government forcing us off of it. And it is also one of the most awesome powers the government has, short of incarceration and conscription, I suppose, is to take people's property through eminent domain. And so just what somebody thinks would be nicer, I don't think that's a high enough standard. I think it's got to be tougher than that. And my last point is a really fundamental point. Mr. Manderscheid had, I think, great statements that he made, but he kind of lost me on his first sentence, because twice he referred to the right of government to take people's property. That does not exist. Government does not have a right to do anything. People have rights. Government does not. And government certainly doesn't have a right to take people's property. And I think that when you start with the assumption that government has a right to take people's property, you're going to end up in a very different place than where I am, at least. In closing, I appreciate many of the comments today, and this is a work in progress. There are certainly additional changes that we will make over the course of the next few weeks, and I look forward to working with everyone, but I would appreciate that we pass this bill out of this committee so I can keep working on it.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. Members, thank you. Again, Representative Johnson will renew his motion that House File 2846, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Chairman Smith's Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails. The recommendation is adopted. Members of the committee stands adjourned.